have half an hour to go. We won't take more. 7:30, we come to a conclusion. But we did go, indeed, a long way from the particulars in the last 2 hours, from the particulars of the University of Chicago and Professor McKeon and his politics of universal rights all the way around the world, and now we bring it back to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And we have with us Martha Nussbaum, the Ernst Freud Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics. She really doesn't need an introduction, and I will not give an introduction to her work, because that would fill up the next half hour, even mentioning all the departments and schools she is engaged in. But what I would want to suggest that we perhaps that we discuss and you focus on, and then we'll see what we can do in half an hour, is this peculiar preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that you of course know, and I just read it for everyone to remember. The very first item which says the recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. This is the kind of work we've seen people being engaged in, but of course this is also the work for intellectuals, because this is a very complicated language here and a very loaded language that is involved here, one that has been roundly disputed for several hundred years, if not all the time, but it's certainly there is a pro and a contra, and I wondered if you could tell us, perhaps make this as a starting point about human rights.
Let me first say something of what my own career has been in connection with human rights. I've been mainly involved in an international movement called the Human Development Movement, which promotes a more humanistic approach to the foundations of development policy in the world, and so therefore working with economists to develop an alternative to an approach focused only on economic growth in outlining the goals of development. And so Amartya Sen, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1998, and I have developed what we call the capabilities approach, which is a view that, at least as I articulate, I mean, there are differences between the two, sets out some prerequisites of a life with human dignity that have a very close relation to the Universal Declaration. We use the word capabilities, not rights, in order to stress the fact that what we want to do is to empower people to make them able to choose the various activities on the list. But the grounding in an idea of human dignity is very similar, and then we have an international association, the Human Development and Capability Association, that aims to influence agencies such as the World Bank, the IMF, to think of development in this richer, more human way. So the language of universal human rights and human dignity is always being contested, and so I just wanted to think about that for a little while, and I think particularly among students that I've taught in my career, there's a very uneasy feeling that what's going on when human rights or human capabilities are recommended is some kind of imposition of Western norms on the diverse nations of the developing world. And so I just wanted to think about that for a couple of minutes, and to say that I think, first of all, what we see when we encounter that kind of resistance is often a certain amount of historical ignorance. I mean, if you think about the ideas of human rights, they don't have their home entirely in the Western tradition. Amartya has written very eloquently about the origins of human rights ideas in Indian traditions and also in Chinese traditions. But I think more important in the modern world, India is the particular focus of my work. Well, the people in India certainly didn't encounter those norms when they encountered the West. They encountered absolutely all the violations of those norms. And they didn't see the West as standing for human rights, not in the least. They saw a regime that violated the rule of law, that subjected Indians to brutal subjection. And so they had to invent these norms out of reaction against what they saw the West as doing. Nehru, Gandhi were certainly not people who were aping the West. They invented what they thought good, and it contained really most of the items on this list in reaction to that. So I think that that's the first thing I'd like to say, that when we look at the experience of colonialism, what we see is again and again people inventing, grabbing for themselves these norms as norms that empower them against their experience of Western brutality. But then there are some much more serious academic arguments that people bring up against the universal value. So just to mention a couple of them and to say what I think we might want to say to them. First of all, there's an argument from culture that says, look, the source of values ought to be in people's own culture, and these universals seem weirdly detached. They seem to be, in some way, whether Western or not, they're impositions from on high. Well, I think the way of responding to that is to begin by thinking that cultures are always pluralities. They are always scenes of argument and contestation. They contain many, many voices. And to say, well, let's turn it over to culture, usually means turning it over to the powerful male voices in that culture. So that's not necessarily a good thing to do. And so if we hear out that cultural conversation, we hear again and again people asking for values that empower them, that give them all a decent shot at a life with human dignity. Another argument points to the good of diversity. This world is becoming homogenized. American culture is everywhere. But don't we really want to try to preserve meaningful kinds of diversity? And don't human values kind of eradicate that? Universal values like the human rights values eradicate a good kind of diversity? Well, here I think, yeah, diversity is very important, but two things here. First of all, we have to ask, first of all, which kinds of diversity are worth preserving? I have no hesitation in saying that if domestic violence disappears tomorrow, we will not miss it. And then finally, there's an argument from paternalism, that is to say, here we have things that seem to go against majority preferences, and what do we say about that? Don't we think we should all be Democrats, and if people vote for something, fine, if they don't, not so fine? Isn't this a kind of objectionable paternalism? And here I think we have to notice that any constitution in any country entrenches some very important things beyond the whim of the majority. And that's usually thought to be a pretty good thing, that we can't vote out the freedom of religion when some majority wants to do that. We can't curtail the freedom of speech when some majority wants to do that. And what the Universal Declaration is doing is just universalizing that, internationalizing it. Now, if we say that these are important values that should be protected for all people in every country, it doesn't mean, and then this is just the final point, it doesn't mean that we're prepared to march in and impose them. There's a very strong distinction, it's very important to maintain, between justifying these as very important norms for everyone and saying we're entitled to implement that. So the whole question of how these values might be implemented was rightly left off the table when the framers were framing this declaration. And my own personal view is that we're rarely, if ever, justified in interfering with the affairs of a sovereign nation in order to impose any vision that we have, whether it's that of human rights or not. So what we're talking about here is norms, persuasion, justification, but not about forcible imposition. So
I think I'll stop there.
Okay. Let's perhaps continue along those lines. I mean, one of the things where diversity turns ugly is, of course, poverty. And you've worked a great deal on poverty, and I wondered, particularly in the Indian context, and I wondered, since the alleviation of poverty is obviously one of the grand goals of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, do you think there is any way to get closer to that goal, even if we never fully achieve it, by way of enforcing basic human rights? What do you think is the link between universal rights or the universal rights structure that we have and the struggle against poverty?
Well, I love the Universal Declaration partly because it doesn't separate the political and civil rights from the economic and social. They're all in there together. Later rights documents did try to make that separation, and they suggested that you could protect political and civil freedoms without worrying about poverty. And that, I think, is just false. And I think our nation has a particularly ugly history, really, of constitutionalizing and protecting certain values, such as the freedom of speech, without thinking at all about how things like the provision of basic education, the very unequal provision of it, are really implicated in protecting the freedom of speech itself. And actually, in the 1970s, there were a couple of Supreme Court cases that did try to say, because, you know, education isn't in the Constitution, so how can you talk about inequalities in education? Well, they tried to say it's inherent in the freedom of speech, and I think that was the right thing to say, although it did not work because of the Reagan Revolution, which quickly swept those justices from the scene or put them in the minority. But yeah, I mean, I think what's important is to see that all rights have an economic and social component, and you don't really have freedom of political participation unless your nation has put you in a position to read and write or and empowered you in a variety of material ways. And so I think, you know, it's only if we have an account of rights, as in the Universal Declaration, that really does focus very strongly on the economic and social, that we're going to get that. But then once you have that, I think they are very closely linked together. That is to say, women in education has been my focus. And if you think of women who have even a primary education immediately have exit options from a bad marriage because they can get a job that's not sex work. And so they can go out and therefore protect their bodily integrity. They can contribute to the economy. They can engage in politics. So these things are all very closely linked together. And if I had to pick just one intervention point in thinking about poverty, of course you shouldn't pick just one, but I would pick education because I do think that that's a key to so many of the others. And of course that has a very strongly economic aspect itself because we know that poor people have a poor education. And so the equalization of educational opportunity, I think, is key.
But then the question is, how do you get from the general premise or the general rule and or the general norm to the specific implication? Is there how do you claim rights? I mean, that, after all, is the entire secret of this enterprise of a human rights regime, not simply that there are norms out there, but indeed that there are people and there is a culture of claiming rights. So how do you get from the, as it were, ideal or the text to the practice? India would be an interesting case but there are many other cases. We could use the United States here as an example. Mm-hmm. I mean, how we get or do not get, from theory to practice, or from text to practice, I should say.
No, and I think India is a better example simply because the founders really focused on that problem from the beginning. And they said, I mean, Nehru said in his Independence Day speech that what he wanted was the end to poverty and misery and inequality of opportunity, mm-hmm. and they set out to do that. Okay, so how do you do it? Well, certainly the provision of education is one of the things that's lagged behind, and that's been a real problem. But I think one of the things that Gandhi thought about, which now recently has been implemented, is reviving this system of rural self-government through village panchayats, in which people are empowered to make very crucial decisions at the village level. So decentralization of politics and empowerment of people, and recently they then said one-third of the seats in these have to be occupied by women. And people thought, oh, that's just a theoretical idea, it won't really work, but it is working. In fact, women are, with great alacrity, they're going into these jobs, and then after their seat is no longer reserved, they're contesting that seat successfully against men. And I think this is what explains, I've looked at, now this last election in the US was different because I think people did vote a lot and young people voted a lot and they voted with great hope and enthusiasm, but before that we didn't see that so often. In India there's a much larger voter turnout than in America, and people really are claiming their rights. I mean, I've been with people who are just desperately poor, don't have clean water at all, but they're talking about what they want. If they can't read, they will draw it, and they will draw a picture of a child prostitute with a big X across it. And how does that happen? Because of the work of people like the organizations the interns were describing, the NGOs that go out and just bring people together. I mean, you don't have to do very much before people start to claim their rights. Just bring them together, especially women who have been isolated in the home. And when they get together, all women, suddenly they discover they're in a group where everyone is equal, and they're no longer at somebody's beck and call. And that is itself a crucial form of empowerment, just the kind of the construction of a relationship of dignity. Leads to more claiming of dignity.
Yes, I think there are really two sides to it, and one side is what you just told us and what we heard in the interns' reports. This wonderful capacity of human beings, really all human beings, to claim rights. I mean, I come from a different neck of woods, but and a different human rights tradition, as it were. But there is at least one very important book out, a historical book, that essentially argues human rights, Menschenrechte in the German context, droit des hommes, equal rights, were really not that much of a problem in southern Germany, in the Alsace and in Burgundy and in parts of Switzerland, because farmers, peasants, and their wives had claimed this for centuries and had struggled for centuries to get it. And by the 18th century, they had gotten a remarkable amount of equal treatment before the law. It's the case is of course a specific one. It's just way back, nice, but the fact that human beings do claim rights as part of their human as part and parcel of their self understanding as dignified people who have self worth, that seems to me very important. And there are two ways to go, and I would want to go, can't go simultaneously both ways. First, I wondered if you, first or second, I don't care. I wondered if you could, if we could reflect a little more on the question of dignity. This, after all, is a term that is incredibly important, is incredibly central to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the UN Charter. But at the same time, it's not an adjudicable kind of word, not an easily adjudicable word. So it sits a little squarely in what is often a legal discussion. That's the one kind of question I'm interested in. How do we understand this notion of dignity? The other question I have is really concerns itself with the powerful of this world, like the Nehrus of this world. I mean, they were indeed fighters for human rights, very much so, but in fighting for human rights, this very powerful group in India and elsewhere bound itself to a certain rule of law.
Yeah.
So why should they? I mean, they have all the power of, well, not all the power of the world, but all the power of the place. Wouldn't it be better, you know, if we were kind of realists, wouldn't it be better for them to think, well, we don't need law? Practical case, the United States is a very powerful country. Does it fare better in the international sphere without recourse to law that binds them? Or does it fare better with adhering to international standards and laws. But this is a question, of course, that is not just an international question, but reoccurs in place after place after place. And it's classically the question, you know, that concerns such adamant defenders or fighters for human rights, very practical fighters for human rights like Nehru, and the entire Indian national liberation elite in the 1940s, which is a miraculous elite in many ways.
Yeah, well, I didn't talk about law, and it's very, very important. So I agree that you need to work from both ends, from the end of solidarity and mobilization, but also from the end of law, because without law, people often aren't in a position to claim their rights. I mean, just to take one example, when women under the Hindu property law system had very unequal shares in agricultural land, that deprived them of something, an asset that they could use to protect their bodily integrity in the home. I mean, in fact, studies have shown that land ownership is the single most important variable in being able to protect yourself against domestic violence in southern India anyway. And so those are changing the property law, therefore, is a very important route to getting women able to move out of the home and join with other women and do all these things I was talking about. So yeah, you have to work from both ends, but why should the powerful do it? Well, you know, I guess I'm a believer in the primacy of ethics, in the sense that if you look at what happened in India and why it didn't happen in Pakistan, the difference is people. And Gandhi had a moral vision that he was, with superb rhetorical skill, able to communicate to the people who worked with him. I don't think Nehru would have been Nehru without that, because suddenly here was this Kashmiri Brahmin who then is washing his pots after dinner and he's spinning his own thread in prison. He would never have done that without Gandhi. And Gandhi had this power of sympathy and compassion that enabled him to bring people into identification with the poorest and the lowest. And that was a tremendous moral power that very few leaders have had. I think Martin Luther King Jr. had it, and then you could probably find a few others. But if you look at Jinnah was a different type of person. He liked his luxuries, and the Pakistani elite very quickly became a kind of self-perpetuating elite that didn't have that same degree of compassion and solidarity with the poor. And I think you could trace the difference between the mess that Pakistan is currently in and the thriving democracy of India really just in those ethical terms. So what I worry about now is that in India, as in every country, you have the talk of greed, financial success, and so on, swallowing up this more humanistic vision. So back to education, I think it's absolutely crucial that all young people have an education that cultivates their moral imagination, that cultivates their capacity to criticize the dominant morality of greed and all of that. Now, I didn't say anything about dignity, so let me say, dignity's tricky, because I've recently been part of some discussions sponsored by the President's Council on bioethics, in which the notion of dignity is used, I think, quite in a slippery way as a conversation stopper. So if people see something, let's say stem cell research, they don't like for some religious reason, but they don't want to give the religious argument, they say, oh, it's a violation of human dignity. So I think we have to learn from that, and we have to be careful to say the concept isn't self-explanatory. It has to be held in place with a lot of other concepts. So, I mean, I think of it holistically, that you can't give an account of dignity all by itself, but you give an account of it in connection with certain other ideas, like respect, like treating a person as an end and not merely a means, and then, in turn, you probably have to flesh that out with much more concrete stuff, political principles, and then you see whether it all hangs together. But what I don't want to do is to say, oh, we have an intuition about what human dignity is, and we know it when we see it, because I see too much of that going on around me. And I think, and then one more thing I'd like to say, Michael, is that for me, it's also a tricky notion, because I also believe that animals have some basic entitlements, and indeed quite a lot of them. And therefore, I think that each species of sentient being has a dignity, And that therefore the human dignity is the human kind of dignity, but there's another kind of dignity that an elephant has, or a horse, and so on. So it's not like dignity is, because we're rational, we have dignity, and no one else has dignity. Dignity is the preciousness, the respect-worthiness of a form of life that's trying to reach its own ends. But there are many such forms of life, and so I would say this conversation that was begun with the Universal Declaration has to lead down the road to that much larger conversation.
Is this perhaps a two-way street in which I discover indeed an Indian influence on your thinking? Or I mean, obviously there is a very strong Western
Michael,
tradition.
It's just the opposite.
I'll
tell you why. Because when in Wider, I kept bringing up all these animal rights notions, Wider being the institute where I worked with Sten and the other Indians. But you see, for them, it codes as the rhetoric of the Hindu right, because of cow protection and all these things. And so Amartya always used to be very hostile to including anything about the protection of animals in any of our documents, because he thought, oh, that's just religious claptrap. But over time, he's become much more persuaded of it. So I think now we're very much on the same page, at least to the extent of protecting animals against cruelty and pain. But his own formation was so much of a reaction against certain kinds of religious... But I think, you know, if you really do look at the Indian tradition, you see a lot of great, great things. Ashoka, the Buddhist emperor in the 2nd, 3rd century BC, already said very eloquent things about cruelty to animals and about why he was trying to be a vegetarian, not fully successfully. And you know, the only court that I know of that's declared that animals deserve constitutional protection and have a right to a life with dignity is an Indian state court in Kerala, which said that in a very interesting case involving circus animals. So, yeah, I mean, so probably I had these ideas before that, but it's certainly interesting to see how they unfold.
I guess the old Spanish law had the right for animals to be punished, but not the right to have rights. Yeah. But one last question. I would have wanted to talk to you a bit more about education, but since we have only a few more minutes, we started this out as a celebration of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the 60th anniversary is on December 10, right? In barely a month. Do you think there is cause for celebration, or is there more cause for ruefully looking back at missed chances? Is there a reason to think that this has become a hypocritical, idolatrous, as Michael Ignatieff would argue, enterprise? Is there reason for celebration?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't... I think it would be ridiculous to say anything otherwise, because I think, you know, what's happening around the world still has an awful lot of bad things, but there's so much awareness everywhere that this is bad, and there's a movement to criticize and change, and particularly since I focus on women, I mean, the change that's taken place in the last 100 years is astronomical. Not necessarily that women are not oppressed, beaten, sold, trafficked, and so on, but that people see that that is bad. That's not just the normal way things are. Now, Kant said that about the French Revolution, right? That somehow it's already a form of improvement in itself, namely the awareness that these things are bad. And so I think just as that period of history brought about the awareness that feudalism and hereditary class structure was bad, well, now we've seen that happen with gender. We are seeing it happen with disability. We're seeing it happen with differences of opportunity from nation to nation. So I do think it's a hopeful time, but I think we can only carry it forward if we really do focus on education, because it's so easy for people to grow up just not with obtuse imaginations, and then we readily slip back again. So I think we should say two cheers, but mourn ourselves, that we have to keep working on it, or else it just becomes dead.
Mm-hmm. And I think with this, I just would want to quote in conclusion of this afternoon, again from the preamble, this is the last paragraph, which reinforces what you just said, and that is the General Assembly proclaims this Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. They argue it's a common standard, right?
Yeah.
Although they start out saying it's inherent dignity and equal and inalienable rights that matter. It's a common standard. They proclaim these standards for the end that every individual and every organ of society, keeping this declaration constantly in mind, shall strive by teaching and education to promote respect for these rights and freedoms, and by progressive measures, national and international, to secure their universal and effective recognition and observance, both among the peoples of member states themselves and among the peoples of territories under their jurisdiction. I think this is a very laudable statement made in 1948, a very enlightened statement. I think it's a statement we still can live with and
we'll
continue to struggle with.
But we have to keep struggling and not rest on our laurels.
Okay, thank you very much, Martha.